You're listening to the Waypoint Podcast Network, brought to you in part by HuntStand, the number one hunting and land management app.
Oh, that's awesome.
Don't miss Thursdays with Saltwater Experience, brought to you by Golden Boat Lifts, every Thursday night from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
A Game Warden's children's book, titled A Cowboy in the Woods, is a story of Bobby, a boy who spends the whole summer observing wildlife, writing notes in his notebook, fishing with his dad, and keeping track of all the animals in his neighborhood, while trying to solve a neighborhood mystery. What he discovers is more than just an appreciation for the natural world. The idea for this book came from Wayne Saunders' own childhood experiences, growing up and exploring the woods and streams and lakes and ponds of his native New Hampshire. The love of nature instilled in his childhood led him to a career as a conservation officer. Wayne Saunders is a retired lieutenant conservation officer from the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department. Lindsay Webb is a naturalist, wildlife biologist, and environmental educator. Together, they collaborated with wildlife artist Ashley Mayers to produce The Cowboy in the Woods, the story of a boy whose love of nature leads him in unexpected directions. Available at wardenswatch.com and Amazon. Warden's Watch Podcast is now on Patreon, combining the Thin Green Line podcast and the Warden's Watch podcast on Patreon to bring member-exclusive extra content, both video, audio, and with product deals as well. Become a member to support our podcast and get something extra. Search Warden's Watch Podcast on Patreon.
We love our children. We protect them. We guide them. We prepare them for life in the world. With all that we do, from deep in our hearts, we cannot control all things. Life-threatening illnesses and disabilities affect far too many of our children each year. While we cannot change the circumstance, we can make dreams come true. Dreams to provide hope, to provide spiritual healing and strength, to provide moments of happiness and relief in the hardest of times. We can give a glimmer of light and hope in a time of darkness and despair. Join huntofalifetime.org to help make dreams come true, to provide hope for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Hunt of a Lifetime is a nonprofit organization fulfilling dreams for hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Visit huntofalifetime.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch. Warden's Watch, episode 76. Brad Danforth, New Zealand. And we're really, I can't even say we're going across the pond anymore. We're going across the world with an interview on Brad. And Brad's certainly been in the United States. You've had a chance to meet him, haven't you, John?
Yeah, we've worked together in the past. Great guy. He really kind of connected the dots before I went over to New Zealand for a hunt several years ago. We unfortunately didn't get to connect over there, though, but that's in the game plan for the future. But so cool to see the enforcement issues through Brad's perspective as a conservation officer over there and how unique the challenges are. And then when I was over there hunting, to see the extensive hunter trespass and the poaching of these trophy stags, these red stag, and how thin their game wardens are over there for these massive expanses, some of those beautiful, beautiful open spaces I've seen on these areas was incredible. And we're going to be hopefully getting him back over here to do some more good work in the future.
Yeah, fisheries officer, we get into that. We get into New Zealand. We talk a lot about New Zealand and the enforcement efforts he did. There's a little bonus in there when we talk about New Zealand hunting, too. So it's going to be a dynamic international podcast with Brad. So I'm really looking forward to it. Remember, give us that star rating if you can. Interact with us on Instagram, Facebook, and such. It's a great thing to hear from our listeners, isn't it, John?
Absolutely, guys. And we appreciate your support always. Let's keep it going.
So this episode of Warden's Watch, it's really cool. You know, I say in our introduction, we go, you know, wardens from around the country and around the world. And we really went around the world this time, all the way to New Zealand with Brad Daniford. And really a pleasure to have you, Brad. Zooming in all the way from New Zealand to New Hampshire and to be able to do this interview. You know, when we started this podcast, we've already talked about some of the people we've known together. Chris Schottmeyer certainly was a great asset to National Marine Fisheries, and Brad knew him. And so it's kind of neat to start making those connections when you're doing an interview so far away in New Zealand and then you bring it home. Brad, that was a good memory that you brought home. So I appreciate that.
I guess I've always sort of thought of the natural resource law enforcement community as just one big family. And I guess in the greater scheme of things, in the wider law enforcement community, we're such a small part of it that we do tend to have connections that maybe other sections of the law enforcement community don't have. But, you know, there's just so many more, whatever, customs officers or, you know, police officers, whereas natural resource, you do tend to develop some pretty close relationships with people.
Yes, no doubt. And it sounds like you spent some time at FLETC with them and our federal law enforcement training there in Georgia. So you've been to the States and Canada, you mentioned. So you've traveled this way.
Yeah, look, I was incredibly fortunate in my career. And when I say fortunate, I probably also was a bit cheeky. And I was forever pestering the bosses about being allowed to. And I'm a great believer is that, you know, the worst thing they could say was no. So I figured it was worth a shot. And I guess every 10th or 12th request I put in, they got sick of me doing it and figured if they approved one, they'd shut me up for a while. And so I got to work, you know, pretty extensively in Australia, but also in Canada with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans in British Columbia there, and met a couple of guys there from the BC Conservation Service as well, and also throughout the States, both just doing ride-alongs and seeing how agencies work, but also did some formal training, you know, a couple of weeks at FLETC. I did my ASBATN instructor's course in Newport News, Virginia. I did a tactical communications instructor course in Kansas City, Missouri. Yeah, I was pretty. I was incredibly fortunate.
Fortunate. Your resume is going to be long with all those certs.
And you just met some, and look, some of it was just me being a typical New Zealander, a Kiwi, just rocking up and going, "G'day, I'm from New Zealand." You know, go and knock on, you know, stand at reception at some fisheries department and say, "Hey, have you got any officers around I can chat to?" And you know, Todd Vandevert is a classic example of that. Was up in Washington State and got introduced to some back then they were separate agencies, fisheries and wildlife, and got introduced to met some fish cops, and they knew some game wardens, and ended up staying with Todd, and you know, I haven't been able to get rid of him since out of my life. So
that's great, and that's exactly how we made that connection. Someone told me Todd, after I did an interview with him, told me he had a friend from New Zealand that was a game warden. So I queried him, and he gave me your info. So that was great. And then when I started talking about you, you know, John Norris, my partner there, he was like, "Oh yeah, Brad, we've talked a lot. We've crossed communications quite a bit. Never met in person, but that would be great." And John's been to New Zealand and done a little hunting out there, and I think his intent is to go back and visit you. So hopefully that'll get on his list and get done.
Yeah, well, that'll be cool because I worked quite a bit with California fishing. Well, was fishing game, fishing wildlife now. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was sort of the first US agency I ever did any work with. I worked with some guys on the opening of the lobster season out of San Diego, and Ben Thompson. He's still there, and a few other guys. Sal Amato, who was he went to the Feds to US Fish and Wildlife, but he was with California at that stage, and that was back in 1993, I think. Nicole Kuzicki, went and spent some time with her up in out of San Francisco, and it was funny, you know, sort of have heard John's name mentioned many times, and a lot of the wardens that I've met over there, and yeah, sort of it's one of those weird ones where we've never actually physically crossed paths, but we seem to know a bit about each other and know lots and lots of people, you know, those connections, which is wonderful.
Yes, no, very cool. So New Zealand, and I told you before, every time I think of New Zealand, I think of Lord of the Rings and all the scenery that was videotaped there. And that's if I didn't live in the United States, that's the next place I'd want to live, because it seems like such an outdoor place. It sounds like, you know, you have lots of game, lots of fish, some beautiful country. And can you just give us a little peek into your country?
Yeah, sure. So we're just east of the middle of nowhere. You know, we're a long way from anywhere. Our nearest neighbor is Australia, and people often think that, you know, New Zealand and Australia are sort of one and the same, but we are very, very different. They're 3,000 kilometers away from us to our west. So what's that, 1,800 miles or something? We're, you know, an island nation, three sort of main islands and then lots of little offshore islands. We're about the same landmass size as California, roughly, but we have an incredibly diverse sort of country in terms of the landscape. I always sort of describe it as being that we have everything that the US has, except for a true desert. We have an alpine desert, but we don't have a true sand desert. But we have everything else, but in a very, very compact, small sort of space. So, you know, you can drive 2 hours in New Zealand and be in completely different landscapes, whereas in the US you seem to drive for 2 hours and you're pretty much, US is huge. And, you know, in certain parts of New Zealand, I think the furthest you can get from the ocean in New Zealand is 100 and... to either 100, I think it might be 160 kilometers. So what's that, 100 miles? That's the furthest you can get from the ocean in any, you know, from east or west coast. Wow. So we're a long, skinny sort of nation. And we have this incredibly diverse range of landscapes. I guess it's been described as the sportsman's paradise or El Dorado, and, a lot of hunting and fishing opportunities over here. So size of California, we have a population of 5 million people. That's it. So there's plenty of cities in the US that have got 5 million people, and that's our whole country.
Right.
And of those, must be close to 1.5 million live in one city, which is Auckland. And then the rest of the cities are, that we've got sort of four or five big cities, which have, you know, 300,000 to 500,000 people, and then lots and lots of towns or small cities of sort of 30,000 to 60,000 people.
Mm. And the other thing I know about
space.
Yes, good. But the other thing I know about New Zealand, because I have a good friend that's from New Zealand too, Owen. I always call him Owen the Samoan. And he did a haka for me the first time.
Give me a second. I apologize. That's the dog swinging a snow that someone's drive. Hey, come here. Sorry. Our dog is a very good watchdog.
That's good. I totally understand. I've got two in my garage right now.
Yeah, that's probably where I should have put her too. She can be a little bit too good at notifying us when vehicles arrived.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. So, yeah, so my buddy Owen, the first time I never heard of a haka before, and he demonstrated it for me, and he's a big boy, and he's muscular, and boy, when he puts all his might in his haka. And if no one has ever experienced the haka, Google it because it's amazing. The rugby team from New Zealand does a haka, and it is pretty impressive. And I've shared that with a lot of people since then because, you know, the first time when you know, like, what's a haka? And then that when they do a proper haka, your hair stands up on the back of your neck and you're going, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so it's a traditional Māori, the indigenous people of New Zealand, and you know that that's their war dance basically, and yeah, our national rugby team is pretty famous around the world for at the start of the match they basically try and scare the shit out of the opposition by doing a haka and try and psych them out right from the outset, and as you say, it's a pretty impressive sight when you when they get and boy they get into it.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And Owen was no exception. Someday I got to videotape him doing a haka because it was impressive. Because I like I said, I didn't know what to expect when he said, "You never seen a haka before." I'm like, "Nah, I have no idea what that is." So he was kind enough to show me that, and I'll tell you what, I was wow, that's something. So yeah, it's definitely a war dance. There's no doubt about it. So that's the other thing I know about New Zealand, which always impressed me. So the mountains, the wildlife, and the haka. So if anybody gets nothing out of this podcast, Google that haka. We might have to put that on an Instagram thing or something when we put this on there for you, Brad, so we can do a proper introduction to you.
Yeah, sounds good. Sounds good.
So 19 years with the fisheries enforcement, correct?
Yeah, so I did, it was 19 and a half. I always sort of joke and say I never got to 20 and got my gold abalone measure or whatever they give you at 20 years. I started as a pretty reasonably young officer. I was 20, 21 or 22, I think. 22 must have been. And I guess had always been hunting and fishing. And, you know, my dad owned a hunting and fishing store shop. Mm. And so had been brought up hunting and fishing all my life, and you know, both trout fishing and sea fishing, marine fishing, and also lots of hunting, particularly duck hunting. Duck hunting's huge here. We've just had the opening of the duck hunting season here in New Zealand last weekend, it sort of, I guess, was also interested, I guess, in that enforcement side of things, and knew a couple of guys who were in fisheries, and it seemed like a pretty cool sort of career, and I guess I was pretty fortunate back then. Perhaps the application and recruitment standards are obviously a lot lower than they were today. I sort of keep looking at I keep looking when they advertise a job now, and I look at the requirements, and I think, shit, I wouldn't mind doing that job, but I don't think I'd be qualified. And joined fisheries, we're a little bit, well, maybe we're not unusual in some ways. We have a number of agencies in New Zealand that do sort of different things, and Ministry of Fisheries, New Zealand Fisheries, all we did was marine fisheries. So I guess in that regard, we were more like, you know, National Marine Fisheries Service, the federal guys. And again, in New Zealand, we don't have the state system. So we have a single jurisdiction in New Zealand. We don't have that state level of government. So we have the New Zealand government, which is, and then we just have local governments, which are like your city councils. We don't have that. And I guess that just reflects our size. So in New Zealand, we have one department for fisheries. We have one conservation department. We have one police department for the entire country. So we don't have the city, the county, the state, the federal level of law enforcement. We purely have a federal system. Mm. So is good in many ways, and perhaps not quite so good. It's just a different way of doing things. I think if you talk to most of the enforcement officers, it solves a lot of problems around there are no jurisdictional issues about, you know, whether you get, because it's one country, and if you're there, you're ours. Yeah, so a young officer posted right up north of New Zealand, and probably, you know, a lot of the same issues that that officers who are involved in marine enforcement in the US or Canada, you know, black market poaching of high value species. We, you know, regulate the commercial industry, and we have a pretty extensive commercial industry. We have, for a small country, we have the fourth largest EEZ in the world. So our exclusive economic zone is massive, because we are an island nation, and it extends 200 nautical miles from every island that New Zealand's responsible for. So commercial fishing is massive here. Started up in the far north, then went down to Wellington, which is our capital city, and it's where a lot of the major abalone poaching takes place, and sort of always wanted to sort of get down there and get into the fun stuff, and did lots of both patrolling, but a lot of surveillance and investigative work. Because of the type of offending down there, it wasn't sort of just patrolling down the beach and writing out tickets. It was very much targeting high value targets, offenders. Lots of mobile surveillance, lots of electronic surveillance, trying to disrupt the major poaching and transportation activities of these offenders. Did that for a number of years, which was great, and then managed. When I had joined, they had shut a lot of the smaller stations. The department had gone through one of those centralisation, decentralisation cycles that agencies seem to go through.
Right.
Someone decided it would be a good idea to open some of these smaller stations again, and I got brought into the head of enforcement's office, a guy called Stan Carruthers, who I actually had a coffee with on Wednesday down in Wellington and caught up with him. And he said, "Well, Brad, I hear you want to go back to New Plymouth," which happened to be my hometown. And he said, "We haven't had an office there for 8 years. You're going to have your hands full." He said, "But let me assure you, the future of small stations rests squarely on your shoulders. If you stuff this up, it will be the last one we open. But no pressure, away you go." So I went up there and I must have done all right, because I hope I did. They opened numerous small stations after that, which was great, and sort of put small offices, one two officer stations, and stayed there for a few years, and then moved into a national role as a national trainer, particularly around officer safety, and was able to convince the department that rather than moving back to Wellington to our headquarters, I could actually stay in my the small town that I lived in and actually do the job from there, and which again, I was incredibly fortunate with the department that they supported me and allowed me to do that. So
nice. Yeah,
a great career, absolutely amazing career. Can't believe I was paid to do what I did.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of wardens feel like that, and so some of your good cases is you did a lot of surveillance, and I'm assuming abalone, is that similar to what we have on our West Coast in California, same kind of shellfish, yep. Correct? Because we don't have any abalone on the East Coast.
No, so abalone, we call it over here pawa, which is P-A-U-A, but it's probably pronounced, you pronounce it P-A-W-A, pawa, but it's abalone, abalone. Very, very high value species, worth a hell of a lot of money. Mm. And of course, anything that's worth a lot of money attracts a lot of attention. And so that was a big focus. Also, rock lobster. And our lobster is not like your main lobster. It's more like it's the same as the West Coast lobster. So it doesn't have the big claws on the front. But again, very high value species. So a lot of time and big commercial fisheries for those species, but also a really significant black market industry that was, we targeted to sort of disrupt. And, it became pretty clear. And what we saw in New Zealand, a pretty significant change in the early 90s, just sort of around the time that I joined, that in the old days, a lot of the offending was done by what I would almost call likable rogues. It was small scale. It was a guy would go out and get a few extra and go and sell them at the local pub or bar, you know, and it was really, it was kind of small scale stuff. And it was, you know, and you know, that you tended to employ the traditional techniques of, you know, a lot of just basic patrolling and creating the deterrent effect. And but in that early 90s, where we saw the demand for some of those high value species skyrocket, and particularly through Asian buyers who just seemed to have an insatiable appetite for some of those species, we saw quite a change in the people who became involved in the exploitation of that of those species. And what we started to see was some quite organized criminal enterprises establishing. And it sort of went from being your likable rogue who had been a hunter and fisherman all his life and just got a bit carried away and sort of took the opportunity to take a few extra, to people becoming involved who actually had absolutely no interest in fisheries, or all it was to them was a means to an end to make a few hundred thousand or sometimes more. And they also brought with them the same sort of techniques that they used in their other criminal enterprises, be it drugs, be it, you know, whatever they were involved in. They just saw fisheries offending as being just another income stream for them. So I guess you saw a far greater sophistication in the types of offenders that we were dealing with and the types of techniques they were employing. So as a result, of course, the department itself had to get a lot smarter around how they were targeting those offenders. And they sort of brought in some officers or recruited some officers from agencies such as the police and customs and tried to really up their capability around the more investigative targeting those really high value targets. So yeah, we do a lot of mobile surveillance and you know, pick a target and say, right, for the next 3 weeks, 24 hours a day, we're sitting on this guy, and everywhere he goes, we go. Cameras in some, you know, in their buildings, and we got some fantastic results. And really, unfortunately, as I guess I'm sure every agency struggles with, as quick as you knock one off, there were five more ready to take their place because there was such big money involved. So that's an ongoing problem, and you know, those agencies are still doing the same stuff. You know, we were one of the few agencies in New Zealand that actually put people undercover into used undercover agents, and you know, very high risk strategy, but a very effective one, and we got some great results out of that. But yeah, it's and it continues to today. That the days of the good old likable rogue poacher, who's a good old boy, is really a thing of the past. You've got really serious criminal activity involved, or criminal enterprises involved in the exploitation of these species.
Did you ever get found out when you were doing those surveillance?
It was quite noticeable over the year. Yeah, I guess anyone who's done a lot of particularly mobile surveillance, if they've never been burnt once, they're probably not either they haven't been doing that much of it, or they haven't been trying hard enough. Uh-huh. Yeah, it was really interesting. It always makes me laugh when you watch TV and you see one or two cars, on some show doing surveillance on a target. Well, yeah, I mean, anyone who's done mobile surveillance just doesn't work like that. No. So, you know, we would generally run a six-car team and sitting on a target. And the interesting thing was, you know, the target would leave their house and jump in the car, and you had no idea whether he was going down to the local shop to grab a package of cigarettes, or on numerous occasions, 8 hours later, we found ourselves in Auckland because he was actually driving to Auckland to either deliver a load or to pick up, to meet with her. So, yeah, it was really, really interesting work. And, a couple of times you got burnt. But what was interesting about the offenders was that if you did get burnt, they would get really gun-shy for a couple of months. Or if, you terminated on them and you caught them, they get really, really, really paranoid, which was great. And they'd start doing active counter-surveillance all day, every day. And But then over a couple of months' time, they'd get more and more relaxed, and then they'd fall back into the old bad habits. Bad habits for them and good habits for us, and we go and knock them off again. So yeah, it was interesting. Some of those surveillance jobs were great, and we remain incredibly lucky in New Zealand over the powers that we had, and perhaps not the same level of not oversight, but yeah, we didn't have to jump through, it seemed, a lot of the same hoops that perhaps other jurisdictions seem to have to jump over around some of the powers we had, and what we were able to do around entries into buildings to install cameras and do good stuff like that. We had pretty much a free rein, which was kind of interesting, and a far greater rein than say the police did, which always sort of amused me, because here they were investigating murder and drugs, and they had to get a warrant for everything, and we would break into warehouses at 3 a.m. and install cameras and didn't need a warrant. We could just do it as a matter of right, basically. So we were pretty fortunate.
Yeah,
so we got some good cases.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And I'm sure, because that resource is pretty protected, it sounds like they take that pretty serious in New Zealand to give you those powers. And if everything's going out of the country, that's another interesting thing when you said you bring in customs, because most of the customers are buying, it's leaving the country. That's a good hub to be connected to, because everything they're probably poaching is leaving.
Yeah. And interestingly, that's now changed in New Zealand. And it was another, what we call choke point. It was another point where, right, we had a really good opportunity to target and try and disrupt that supply chain. And we got made a number of very, very good cases where we couldn't take credit for it. It was customs picking it up as it was leaving the country in a refrigerated shipping container or something like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that was another really good point for us to be able to target them. But what has happened in New Zealand is that we have seen over the last 10 or 15 years a really significant increase in migration to New Zealand, and including from countries that traditionally were the end user of a lot of those products. And now that population in New Zealand is big enough that pretty much a lot of the illegal take is absorbed within the New Zealand communities. So now, instead of having to get it out of the country, really they just have to get it to Auckland, which is still the main sort of population base. And there is a large enough willing population in that city to pretty much take everything they can get. So it means we've lost that additional choke point of where they had to actually get it out of the country, and that was a bit more challenging for them.
Yeah, because that's what I focused on. I'm like, if it's leaving the country, that's a good spot to emphasize on it, for sure. I mean, that point where they're bringing it to shore, too, is a great spot as well. And you guys had that covered with your surveillance and patrol, I would imagine, and, you know.
Yeah, we you know, what we worked out pretty quickly, and we still made some good cases when you were, you know, on patrol, and sometimes, you know, you literally stumble across, you know, something, but we would spend a lot of time doing surveillance on the coast, and simply gathering intel. And we would let people leave with hundreds of abalone, but we would then, you know, build the intel on the vehicles they were using and who they were associating with. And then, you know, I guess there were times where we would accept that we would let them take, you know, hundreds of abalone, but the intel we were able to gather, and then set up a major operation and, you know, capture them with tons of abalone further down the track, was seen as a better option. And because if you put them before the court, when you caught them with a few hundred abalone, they would get a level of penalty. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you could spend the time and build that significant case against them, and often we were, rather than targeting the divers, and you know, these organized criminal groups, they would pay groups of divers to go out, and they might be 8 or 10 groups of divers operating on a coastline. Rather than picking off those, you know, individual groups, what we wanted to target was the middlemen, the people who were actually
bringing it all in, and they would be collecting off 8 or 10 different groups, and then paying them, and then distributing them up to Auckland. That they were the people we were after. So we would often forego, or sometimes forego, some of the smaller bottom end sort of operators, and try and get them to lead us to the bigger fish were, excuse the pun, in the chain, and target them. So yeah, no, we made some really big cases, and again with the undercover operatives, you know, we put a couple of really major operations that were done. We put people into those gangs. We set people up as buyers of illegal product. They created a, you know, a persona of being the middleman, and you know, some of those operations. And on one, I remember the agent bought 9,000 lobster in about a 3-month period of various people. And of course, when we were able to take them down, we made a really serious dent in the activity. So you know, it was quite a change, and very much the ministry decided that, rather than focusing on the small level writing tickets to sport fishermen and that sort of thing for having a couple of undersized fish, the real damage to the resource was being done by those high level offenders, and that's where our time and effort was far better to be spent targeting those. So yeah, it still goes on. They still have to maintain a uniform presence and that good deterrent value for the sport fishery, for the commercial industry, doing the checks. But there is far more emphasis on what we would call intelligence-led enforcement here, targeting this really serious offenders, looking at what your actual true risks are to the resource. And putting your efforts into targeting them.
Yeah, no, definitely making the bigger difference by doing that. So taking out the bigger kinpids, bringing down their whole structure of illegal activity when you did that. So
yeah, and I guess very similar to, you know, when you think of very similar to drugs. You either target the street level pusher who's, you know, selling however much, or you target the distributor, you target the person who's running the 20 or 30 street pushers, and that's very much, or the importer, and that's very much the mindset that we took. And I guess, you know, working with guys like, you know, Todd Vandervoort, and as much as it pains me to say, Todd was probably the best officer I ever worked with in my life, not that I would ever admit that to him. He really got me thinking. I guess as a young officer, when I first sort of met Todd, it was about, you know, going out and writing tickets. And he, I guess, kind of early on realised that, yeah, you can go out and target the mum, dad, and the kids, or you could really target the serious offenders, and actually they are the people that are doing the real damage, and that's where your time should be spent. And I'll never forget, it was Todd that introduced me to the term writing chicken shit tickets, and he used he said you can either write chicken shit tickets, or you can actually go out and target people who are really doing the damage. And, you know, you can spend your career, you know, targeting the low-level stuff, or you can really make a difference. And, I guess that's what certainly Fisheries in New Zealand tried to move away from that low-level offending and start to target the really big stuff.
Yeah, no, that it makes a lot of sense for sure. Yeah, you know, the other thing I saw, you did a post not that long ago, is your Rangers. Now, I'm assuming that's the Department of Conservation. You had a post there recently. No, it is.
Well, yes and no. So, we have quite an unusual system in New Zealand and particularly around. And I'll give you the quick overview. So you have it's now Ministry for Primary Industry. So Fisheries in New Zealand, they do your marine fisheries. You then have the Department of Conservation. And the Department of Conservation is responsible for all our national parks and all native species. So they would be, I guess, the equivalent for you of your National Park Service at a federal level. And I guess the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but only as it relates primarily to our indigenous or native species. So any smuggling of native birds, protected wildlife, they would be doing that. In terms of our sport fishing for freshwater, so freshwater sport fishing, but primarily trout fishing, which New Zealand is obviously pretty famous for, and we've got an incredible trout fishery here. So trout fishing and game bird hunting is administered by an organisation called Fish and Game New Zealand. And Fish and Game New Zealand, they report to the Minister of Conservation, so which would be like your Secretary of the Interior, but they are not technically a government agency. I said to someone, it would be like Ducks Unlimited taking over the responsibility for the management of game bird hunting in New Zealand. So they are funded purely from the sale of licenses, and you don't need licenses for much in New Zealand. The only thing you need a license for is to hunt game birds, so ducks and pheasants and quail, and for freshwater trout fishing. So they're the only two things you need a license for. And Fish and Game New Zealand gets all its funding purely from license sales, and their agency is a small agency, and they do all the management, what you would have called biologists, and they do the enforcement. And really, the enforcement in that is more around making sure people have got licenses and are sticking to the limits. So I hold and I've held for many years, although I work for fisheries, I held a warrant. We call it a warrant. You'd probably call it a commission, I guess, for Fish and Game New Zealand that enables me to go out and enforce those fish and game laws as well. And even though I've left the fisheries, New Zealand fisheries, I still maintain that commission with Fish and Game New Zealand. And they also happen to be one of our very good clients in our company that I've established. And so it's really good for me to also keep my skill, my hand in, because as a trainer now with a training company, I'm a great believer that the day that you hang up your badge or the clock starts ticking, and suddenly, it's all right for the first few years. The stories are still pretty relevant and the experience is pretty relevant, but pretty quickly time marches on, and suddenly you find yourself talking about experiences or situations that happened 5-10 years ago, and you start to think, gee, I'm not sure this is quite so relevant. So by still going out and maintaining my appointment with Fish and Game, it allows me to get out in the field and go out and check hunters and check fishermen and maintain those operational skills, which is great. And I call it operational currency. And there's no better situation than approaching a group of hunters who have all got shotguns, and there's dogs running around, and you're in the middle of nowhere, and a couple of them have been drinking. That's a pretty good way to hone your risk assessment skills and make sure that you're still maintaining those good techniques to make sure we keep everything safe and keep things going well. So yeah, go out and do that. And so we had the opening of the duck hunting season here in New Zealand last weekend. Big event. It's about 45,000 hunters participate, 45 to 50,000 hunters in New Zealand. So yeah, it's a pretty big deal. And went out with them and had a great day out. Everyone was happy to see us, as is not often the case. And but nice to be able to put on that uniform again and just go out and as I said, deal with some hunters. And a couple of our other trainers came out with us, and again, they're both very experienced law enforcement officers, but also good for them to keep their skills up. So yeah, we have a very different system in New Zealand. A lot of the agencies like Fish and Game New Zealand and Fisheries New Zealand use what you would call deputy officers, reserve officers, so members of the public, which is now what I'm classed as because I don't work for the government anymore. Different style of, enforcement. Much more, particularly in terms of the patrol work, the actual the out there, the, much lower key than perhaps in the US and even Canada to a degree.
Yeah. So those officers aren't armed.
No. So again, if you see a New Zealand police officer walking down the street, they won't be carrying a firearm.
Okay.
So our police don't carry firearms on a day-to-day basis. So we, and again, it's a really hard thing to get people to, particularly from the US and probably Canada, although I think New Zealand's far closer to Canada than perhaps the US, both in terms of our governance system and, we have a very different style of law enforcement. We have a very different, I guess, and I'm not saying it's better, and I'm not saying it's worse. We just have, there is a very different relationship in New Zealand between society and law enforcement agencies. Mm-hmm. And one of the principles in New Zealand, as it is in a number of other countries such as England, is we police or we enforce by consent. We have the support of the public, and that the public supports the agencies that are enforcing it and policing it. And it's just a very, very different, not to say we don't have problems here in New Zealand, but when you look at the relationship, I guess the respect that society has for enforcement agencies, again, it's changing. It is changing slowly, but it's very different style. When, as a fishery officer, I carried a set of handcuffs and I arrested lots and lots of people, but I never had any other sort of. I mean, I've gone to a few fist fights and a few, I called it rolling in the sand with people. I did a bit of rolling in the sand with people, mm-hmm. But New Zealand has never lost a natural resource officer. We've never had a fishery officer killed. We've never had a fish and game ranger killed. We've never had a Department of Conservation officer killed.
That's an awesome record.
Well, yeah, it's just different. It's, as I said, I'm not saying it's better. I'm not saying it's worse the way that we do things here, because I'd never be so arrogant as to say, you guys need to learn what we do. We have, our countries have evolved quite differently. For example, with firearms, we don't have the right to have firearms in New Zealand. It is a privilege to have firearms in New Zealand. Although we have a very, very high firearms ownership here in New Zealand, because of the amount of hunting that goes on. But in terms of handguns are extremely tightly controlled. I wouldn't say it's impossible to own a handgun in New Zealand, but it is extremely, extremely hard. You can't hunt with handguns. You can only you can belong to a pistol club for competitive shooting, but that's it. You can't take a handgun out and say, "Hey, let's go out to a farm and go out and do some shooting." You can only possess them at a pistol club and use them at a pistol club. So you just don't. In my 30 years now of being involved in natural resource law enforcement, I have never come across a handgun. In 20-odd years as a fishery officer, I might have come across two or three rifles that were aboard commercial fishing boats that they'd used to shoot sharks. Obviously, with fish and game, everyone you approach has got a shotgun, hunting right. ducks. But I've never felt threatened by anyone who's had a firearm. So just a very different. It's just a very different. We had a police officer killed a couple of months ago in New Zealand, was shot dead by an offender. That was the first New Zealand police officer that had been killed for 12 years. So, just a very, very different style of enforcement here in New Zealand.
Interesting. The other thing that kind of struck me was the color of the uniforms. The blue stands right out at most fisheries and wildlife people. We have a tendency of the greens and the browns and the was your uniform blue as well?
Yeah. So fisheries, we were, in fact, and I'm just trying to think now, basically most agencies in New Zealand, blue is seen as the enforcement sort of color, I guess.
Right, like our police would be blue.
Yeah, so customs. So if you, and actually, when I was with fisheries, I actually sort of suggested we changed somewhat and differentiate ourselves. I mean, in some ways it was good because the people sort of, I guess they associated blue, members of the public associated blue with government law enforcement.
Right.
But in New Zealand, if you look at a customs officer, a fishery officer, a biosecurity officer, a corrections officer, a police officer. They all wear blue. Some of them wear slightly different outers, you know, but blue is a very common color here, as it is, you know. And I'm just thinking about, we train a lot of the Australian natural resource enforcement agencies, our company does. And even over in Australia, a lot of those agencies, blue is an enforcement sort of color. Mm-hmm. And not saying it's good, not saying it's bad. Sometimes it was, blue wasn't the best color. But of course, if we were out on the coast or doing something, we'd always have a camo jacket with us, or, we'd have our gear that we could throw over the top. It is a pretty common color here in New Zealand.
Yeah, especially if you're trying to watch those duck hunters or something, try to blend in with a little camo cord.
To be fair, Fish and Game doesn't really even have a formal uniform per se. Those are what we were wearing with the vest. They'll tend to wear. I always refer to it as they wear more branded clothing than a true uniform. In the case of what we were the three of us were wearing. Our company distributes. Where training is our biggest part, but we also do some gear as well. And they were some load bearing vests that we sell, so we were wearing those. But if you saw a New Zealand police officer walking down the street or a fisher officer, you'd they look really similar to a US or a Canadian officer, except when you look at their duty belt, and then you'd see they're not going to be carrying a firearm. That's where it perhaps is different.
Mm. And I like the Ranger right down the center of the vest too. I thought that was kind of neat. The Ranger, it said Ranger right down the center of the vest. Yeah. That I like that. I was like, wow, that really lets people know who you are and trying to announce it. And that definitely separated from your local law enforcement. Even though you were in the same colors, you had that Ranger right on the front of that uniform that looked pretty dang sharp, I thought.
Yeah, I sort of like that. Actually, a lot of the Australian agencies use those load-bearing vests with the center patch. Mm-hmm. And I really like them. Like the Victorian Fisheries, who we train, their officers wear a virtually identical vest, and right down the center of their vest is Fisheries. It's really distinctive, because from 5 or 10 meters away, some people might struggle to be able to separate what some officers look, because they're wearing very similar uniform, blue shirts, blue pants, blue shirt, until you actually can read the shoulder patch, what it says, it's a bit hard. Whereas with that right down the center, it's certainly nice and clear.
Yeah. So all this experience and everything sets you up to what you're doing now. And I'm kind of interested in the training that you're doing with your company CERT, right?
I was incredibly privileged in my career with fisheries, in the number of opportunities I was provided with to go and do courses overseas and, work with agencies around the place. And when I sort of joined the National Training and Development Unit for fisheries, became involved around particularly the safety and the tactical communications training. And it's something that, we really focus on in New Zealand around that, not even so much de-escalation training. We call it non-escalation techniques. So where a lot of agencies will say, we need de-escalation training. Well, if your training is pitched at de-escalation, that means the situation is already escalated. If that's where your training is starting, it means you're accepting the situation is going to escalate in the first place, and then you're going to train staff how to de-escalate it. A big part of the focus in New Zealand is what we call non-escalation training. So how can an officer engage with a member of the public so it doesn't escalate in the first place? And so particularly around that tactical communications training, and I'm a sort of great believer that most interactions are won or lost inside about the first 15 seconds. So what happens in the first 15 seconds tends to sort of determine where that interaction is going to go, further down the track. So we in fisheries, we invested a lot of time and energy in training our officers around those what we thought were really appropriate skills around managing interactions, so they weren't escalating in the first place. And I guess fisheries got recognised by other agencies in New Zealand around what we were able to achieve in terms of a reduction in incidents that officers were dealing with through the training we were providing them. And we saw a pretty significant reduction in it, and, you know, what we call officer safety incidents once we started introducing this training. And so other agencies started coming to us and saying, hey, look, you know, we're pretty interested in this sort of training. And what sort of started to happen is that some smaller agencies started approaching me and saying, look, we're not big enough, like for some of the city councils, so animal control officers or parking officers and remembering, so each city doesn't have its own police department. We have a national police service. So with a city council, their parking officers, they were part of just the city council. So they didn't have perhaps some of the training opportunities that other agencies might have. So they started approaching me and I started getting requested, could you come and do some training for us? And as you know, in a private capacity. And I cleared it with our agency and they said, yeah, fine, go for your life. You know, go and go. You know, they were really happy to sort of try and help other agencies. And so I started going and doing this training on the side, I guess you could call it. And I, you know, I'd take leave or I'd do it in my weekends or my days off and I'd start training. And it just kept growing. And the more training I seemed to deliver, the more interest there was. And I guess agencies were talking to each other and saying, oh, we just had this, you know, tactical communications training. We have, you know, da, 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 da. And I actually was sitting and I was still trying to do my full-time role with fisheries, you know, and travel all over New Zealand, delivering training around that. And I remember I was sitting in a meeting one day and the then head of enforcement, we were talking about a project that was going to be set up. And he turned to me and he said, Brad, I'm going to get you to take the lead on this project. And I was sitting there thinking, how the hell am I? I've got all this training coming in, private training, and I've got no leave left because I've used up all my leave. And I sort of turned to Andrew and I said, I'm going to have to resign, Andrew. And I've been thinking through this in my mind, but of course, when I sort of said it, obviously he sort of pulled his head back and he goes, well, it's not that bad, the project I'm asking you to do. You know? And I said, no, it's not the project. I said, mate, you know what I've been doing with this, you know, private training. And I said, look, I've actually got myself into a bit of a spot here that I'm sort of run out of leave and I've got all these commitments. And he goes, and he said, yeah, that's fantastic. That's great. You know, I'm you know, good on you. He said, do you want to take some leave without pay? And so do you want to take a period of, you know, you go off and just take some leave? We won't pay you, but, you know, you go and do this training. And I said, oh, that'd be absolutely fantastic. And he said, well, what do you want? Do you want 3 months? So I said, yeah, that'd be great. So I took the 3 months leave without pay from the department and I went and did this training, this private training. Well, that was great, but because I did all this training, all these agencies started talking to other agencies and I started getting a whole lot more training coming. And I went back after 3 months and I said, Andrew, I've got a whole lot more than that. And he goes, that's all right. Do you want to take another 3 months? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. So I went and did another 3 months. And so I had 6 months, leave from the department. And I still had a whole lot more training coming. So I went back to Andrew. I said, look, in fairness, he goes, hey, well, why don't you come back? But come back on a 0.5. So come back on a, so all you have, you know, work instead of working a 40-hour week, just work a 20-hour week. And he said, in fact, you don't have to work 20 hours every week. We'll set it up that it's 0.5 over, say, a month. So there might be some weeks you work 40 hours, but there might be other weeks you don't. As long as you can ensure that you are covering all the training that you need to do and the work I need you to do, I'm happy. And I think, you know, it's a good opportunity for us to bring another officer up into the training role and we'll put him on a 0.5 training and sort of 0.5 field duties. And that way it gives them some exposure. You know, and I was like, oh, wow, that would be amazing. That would be, anyway, so I did that for about 6 months. More work started coming. And I went back to him, I said, wait, look, I've got to, you know, I'm going to have to pull the pin. And he said, no, well, do you want to go down to a 0.2? So I was effectively I was working effectively one day a week for fisheries, still employed by them, still holding all my government conditions. I was so incredibly privileged how well I was looked after and that opportunity that I was given to grow my private business, I guess, while still working for the government. And I to this day, I remain just so humbled by the support that the agency gave me. And, you know, you talk to other people from other agencies and they just shake their head and they say, man, our agency would never let us do that. And look, I guess I would like to think that it was recognition of the effort that I'd put in over the years, and I certainly gave my heart and soul to the department over the years, and it was my life, you know. I wanted to. I loved the job, and I think there was some. I'd like to think there was some recognition. I think also probably the department wanted to try and keep using me as a resource, given the amount of effort and investment they'd made in me and sending me off on these training courses all over the world. So, yeah, I was incredibly fortunate. And so in the end, towards the end of my career, I was working a 0.2 of a career, which was wonderful. And then ultimately the department had a major restructure, and it got amalgamated into a much bigger department. And we had started, when I originally joined, we'd started in a bigger department as one sort of division of a bigger department. And then we had split out and become a standalone agency, the Ministry of Fisheries. And then, as often happens, that whole centralisation, decentralisation thing happened, and we got absorbed back into a much bigger agency again. And I wasn't particularly comfortable or sure that was a great idea. I sort of felt that probably what would happen, and I would suggest time has proven that right, is that the focus sort of went off fisheries, and officers started getting involved in a whole lot of other stuff that, as part of the wider agency, that probably wasn't really what they should have been doing. And so I'm at that point, I made the decision, this is probably a really, really good time for me to finally, you know, sever those ties formally. And I retired and worked full time on the private company, which CERT stands for Compliance Enforcement and Regulatory Training. So it's a private company, and we train lots of agencies here in New Zealand. You know, we hold the national contract to train the Department of Conservation. We train Fish and Game New Zealand. We train all sorts of Ministry for the Environment, lots of councils who do environmental enforcement or compliance. We train our managed isolation facilities here in New Zealand that manage all their COVID isolation facilities, all sorts of people. We have about 60 organisations that we train. We train Air New Zealand. We have the national contract to train Air New Zealand or their cabin crew on disruptive passenger management. Really wide range. I mean, it started off very much on those sort of enforcement, as the name sort of suggests, compliance and enforcement. But now we train all sorts of people. We do a lot of training for librarians. And you kind of go, well, what are librarians need to know compliance and enforcement skills? Well, they don't need to know compliance and enforcement skills, but they do need people management skills. You know, sometimes there's some young guys in the library making too much noise.
Keep them quiet. That's the library's got to be quiet.
So the librarians have to go and approach these people and engage with them. So we teach them how to assess the situation and how to engage and communicate with people in a way that using non-escalation techniques so that they are able to achieve the outcome they're looking for without the situation starting to escalate. So really I suggest what our company does now is we train people who deal with people. Doesn't really matter why you're dealing with them, doesn't matter what the subject of conversation is, doesn't actually, all we're doing is teaching you how to engage with people and how to do it in a way that we manage that interaction to keep everyone safe but achieve the outcome we're looking for. So it doesn't matter if you're a game warden, a ranger, an officer, a flight attendant on a plane. It's dealing with people skills. And we established the same company in Australia. So we now hold some pretty significant contracts training agencies over there. And so it's sort of grown from me being the company being me to We now have sort of 7 trainers, and all the trainers are former law enforcement officers, you know, either fisheries or police. And yeah, we're incredibly fortunate that a lot of agencies trust us to train their staff to keep them safe. So yeah, which is fantastic.
Very interesting. Yeah. And I, you know, maybe it's because I am a game warden, but I have seen that game wardens have good communication skills. And I'm not sure if it's because the type of work we do, because we engage so many people on so many different levels. It's not always a bad situation. It can be a good situation. It can be in the field. It can be, you know, teaching an education course. It seems like we build those communication skills. And the other thing I think we build is that sixth sense that we know when something's wrong and it's not right. And I've always told the younger guys, come and believe that, because there's something in what we do when we communicate with people instills that there's a problem when there's a problem. I always tell them, believe that, because there's a problem there. If you think there's a problem, and even if there isn't, take it as a problem, and you can sort it out later. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, no, look, I think you're quite right, and you know, incredibly humbling that the New Zealand police, and look, rightly or wrongly, that the police will, and we have an incredibly professional police service here in New Zealand. You know, we are very blessed as a country to have such a professional police service here. They have about 10,000 officers, I think. And they will always be seen as the leading agency for law enforcement in New Zealand. Well, the New Zealand police came to our company and they bought our tactical communications package off us, and we delivered the training to their instructors, who then went out and rolled it out across the whole agency. So, and you know, that was a huge, I guess, kudos for us. I mean, one thing the police can be a little bit, and as I said, it's probably a little bit different in the US, in that, you know, you might have a police department with 5 officers in it, you know, in a small town. Well, we don't have, it would be like, and I can only liken it to, it would be like the FBI coming to someone who has been a game warden for the last 20 years and has developed some, and the FBI buying your tactical communications package off you, because they've actually recognized how effective it is around that non-escalation training. And that was a really significant milestone for us, I guess. And I don't take any credit. I think what it comes back to is the vision of fisheries in identifying the need for that training, and then sending someone, who happened to be me, off to go and look at all the different programs around various countries, and then develop something that was suitable for New Zealand, and bring it back and introduce it, and then see all the other agencies go, wow, that's really good. We're going to start introducing that as well. So yeah, really, really fortunate in that regard. And as I said, a kudos to fisheries as being now. And I think most agencies or anyone involved in training and would recognise that fisheries were probably the lead agencies around that tactical communications training here in New Zealand. Yeah.
Very interesting. Well, we've been talking about an hour now, Brad, so I figured we'd wrap it up, and maybe we'll do something in the future together. And, you know, it's awesome. We went across the pond to Scotland, and now we're in New Zealand, and, you know, I'm holding up that pledge to go around the world. So, and you're part of that, and just Todd Vandevert connecting us, I really appreciate him. Yes, he's a dynamic person for sure. I really enjoyed his interview.
Hey, look, I tell you what's really, really interesting. I put that post up on Facebook, and I think it was, I put it on one of the warden's pages on Facebook of us out, and I got a number of private messages on Facebook from guys who wanted to trade patches with me, and I have a huge collection of patches from my various travels around the world.
I don't actively
collect them, yeah, like I used to, but I've got, you know, hundreds of patches and badges. But I also got a message from an officer in I won't say which province it was in Canada, who has an active investigation going involving someone who with links to New Zealand. And he reached out to me and said, hey, can you either help me, or can you put me in touch with the right people in New Zealand to give me some assistance around some intelligence or some information on this person. And so, more than happy to do that. So I think that's, one of the great values of this community and what you're doing is you're actually connecting people all over the world who are really similar. I've always found natural resource, be them game wardens or fish cops or whatever, mm-hmm. we're all kind of the same. I've always said I've never met a game warden I didn't like or I didn't get on with. I think being able to recognise that we are a really small sector of the law enforcement community, but we're a really tight knit one, and to try and develop those relationships and the world's getting smaller in terms of people coming here hunting or people going to Canada and the US, so we will start to find that we'll probably be more international sort of investigations. And if you can pick up the phone and say, hey, because you know someone in one of those other countries, it certainly makes it a lot easier. So I really hope that I get to stay involved in that community for many years to come.
Great. So Brad Damonford, did I say that right again? I'm butchering it.
Hey, I get called all sorts of names.
Danaford, right?
Anything you call me. Danaford. Danaford. It's Danish.
Yeah.
Danish originally.
Brad Danaford, New Zealand. So thank you for spending some time with Warden's Watch Podcast, Brad. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure the listeners will too.
Yeah. Hey, anytime anyone's coming to New Zealand, give us a call. Love to meet anyone who comes down this way.
Awesome.
Thanks, Wayne.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experience of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders,